The Mark Stein Club Q&A, live around the planet, begins in 30 seconds.
Hey, this is Mark Stein. This month, a great Broadway lyricist will be blowing out 100 candles on his birthday cake, Lee Adams. I'll be playing his songs, starting with his first hit show, Bye Bye Birdie. And we'll celebrate a literary Sinatra. Plus, James Taylor, Roberta Flack, Matt Monro on the town Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. August 7th, 2024. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where the Director of Public Prosecutions, a man called Stephen Parkinson, he deserves to be better known. A man called Stephen Parkinson, Director of Public Prosecutions. If you're Australian, Canadian, various other parts of the Commonwealth, you'll know what that is. Not sure what the precise US well, I suppose whoever it is, who decides who gets prosecuted? Is the district attorney in America? Whoever it is. 8 p.m. in London, where the Director of Public Prosecutions, Stephen Parkinson, is threatening to arrest people for retweets. So we're going to have to retweet the tweet I saw saying he's going to be arresting people for retweets. Come and get me, you totalitarian fairy. 9 p.m. in Paris, where the... I shouldn't say that, actually, because Keir Starmer's now threatening to have people extradited to the UK for their social media. 9 p.m. in Paris, where the Olympic ladies' boxing title will be contested by two biological men. If you think that's great for shattering the glass ceiling... It's probably safe to retweet it. If you're a bit queasy about it, you probably don't want to be retweeting that stuff either. 10 p.m. in Istanbul, where Sultan Erdogan is threatening to invade the Zionist entity. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran, for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran in solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu, for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, you know I'm sorry about that. 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, still kind of sorry, although sunrise is awfully agreeable in Australia. Although it's winter down there, isn't it? So probably a bit later than it is up here. 7 a.m. in Auckland, and a rather more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. 50 years ago today, August 7th, 1974, the French high wire artist Philippe Petit walked between the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center, roof to roof, back and forth, making 8 passes in 45 minutes. It was an unauthorized performance. He had gained access to the top of the building by pretending to be a writer for a French architecture magazine. When they heard what was happening, the New York Police Department came up to the roof and threatened to pull him off the rope by helicopter. I'm sure that would have gone well. Monsieur Petit instead continued his performance until the rain made his rope too slippy. The publicity worked out well for the World Trade Center, which prior to the stunt had been having difficulty filling the office space. Okay, let's get to your questions. As you know, I wasn't here last week, and I did say that the only thing I'd really paid any attention to was Viktor Orban's speech in that Romanian village, a Romanian village of a few hundred people, being addressed by a Hungarian prime minister, and it's more interesting than any of the G7 guys had to say. And he's quite right, and this is what you should bear in mind. As he explained it all, he shouldn't have to, because the preponderance of our listeners live in countries that have at one time or another been the dominant powers. But he explained that, you know, we've gotten used to change being within the West. France losing to Britain at the Battle of Trafalgar, the fall of the great European empires at the end of the First World War, the United States becoming the dominant world power after the Second World War, all the changes within the West. He said that's not going to happen now. We've got a once in a half millennium change. With China and other Asiatic powers on the rise and the Western powers on the decline. And you should keep that in mind. And you should be wondering why your crappy leaders, why it takes a Hungarian prime minister to talk about it. Why your French guys and your American guys and all the rest, they never talk about it. Why do they never talk about it? Ask Kamala Harris. Oh, I forgot. She doesn't do interviews. Fabulous. Fabulous, that is, isn't it? But so that's the big thing. That's the big takeaway. I wrote about it in After America, which is 13 bloody years ago now. You know, somebody, a very dear showbiz friend of mine, said to me not so long ago, he was slightly horrified at what was happening to his country. And he said, I read America Alone when it came out. And he goes, and essentially we're living in that world now. It's all come to pass. Anna Neiman, I hope I said that right, says, greetings, dear Mark. It is a daily delight to hear you share the day's episode of Tales for Our Time. Despite daily headlines describing that sort of sad, long nightmare that Mr. Potts evidently experienced. Mr. Potts is an American millionaire who comes a bit of a cropper on a visit to the British Isles. If you haven't been following Bulldog Drummond, it's well worth following. It's got plenty of action. Still, I can find little in the news about the roiling violence in England. I take it you're referring to the American newspaper. It could be the European newspapers. I was reading some of the French coverage and some of the German coverage today, which I thought was incredibly shallow and ill-informed. And I did see some Associated Press pieces and whatnot in America, and I thought that was shallow and ill-informed too. The roiling violence is, well, as I said the other day, I think it was yesterday, it's not just England, also Belfast, where the BBC, it gave me such a laugh, like the BBC reported that at the anti-migrant protests, there's guys carrying the Irish tricolour and there were guys carrying the Union Jack. So whether you're a papist or a prod, you don't want the migrants. They finally found a point in common after all these centuries. And they're quite right. And they're quite right, because if you think about it, the great thing about the so-called Irish question is that its parameters have been known for years. So you can be in some not terribly agreeable part of that island. You can be in Dundalk, which is a tough town, and you want to think twice about, stopping and going to the pub in Dundalk if your inclinations go certain ways. But the point is this: those Belfast guys are quite right. If you're a papist, would you rather live among a bunch of prods, or would you rather live among Somalis and Afghans? You know, what is happening throughout most of the Western world. It's slightly different in the United States, but Canada is Islamizing. Western Europe is Islamizing. The United States, as I always say, is turning into more of a giant Latin American favela. And when you have, as the Irish could tell you, when you have people who have to share the same physical space but have big disagreements on things, then your politics becomes tribal. So so what matters is who's the top tribe and who's the bottom tribe. And if you watch, for example, I think is it West Midlands Police or Greater Manchester? One of the biggest constabularies in England, chief superintendent or whoever he is, Tommy Robinson had a very funny line because he posted the video and he said, it looks like a hostage video. The guy is sitting there in his uniform, surrounded by the big shot imams all around him. And he's doing the, oh, salam alaikum, although he's, you know, doing it in whatever he's doing, his Brummy accent. Or, oh, salam alaikum. Is that Yorkshire? I don't know. Never very reliable on stuff like that. It's... The state in the last couple of weeks in England has chosen a side, and it's not the side of the people who are upset about migrants stabbing children. Everyone's forgotten that. The three little girls who are dead, 6 years old, 7 years old, 9 years old, and their final moments were as horrible as any death can be. Some guy plunging a knife into them. A six-year-old girl has no idea why this guy is just plunging a knife into her. And her final moments, you know, we say all this, at least death was merciful, just died in his sleep, at least death was merciful. Oh, it was just a sudden explosion, he wouldn't have felt any pain. Well, these three little girls felt pain, and they're forgotten. And the horrible, hideous British establishment, whom I loathe with every fibre of my being, don't care about that. They think, as they said on that first day, when the Home Secretary decided to quote herself, the Home Secretary herself decided to quote manage, unquote, the story, that what matters is tamping it all. Oh, yes, it was a Welshman who suddenly went berserk and stabbed the little girls. Just one of those things could happen. Excitable people, the Welsh. Because of the fraudulence of the media coverage and the police reaction, people got upset about it. It's not just that their children are being stabbed. It's just that the most powerful organs of the state are lying to you about it. And that can't go on. Now, people say, oh, well, they got this wrong because there was some, you know, Russian disinformation site that put out the story. It was an illegal migrant, a Muslim, who just got off the boat. And in fact, it turns out to be a Rwandan guy who was born here 17 years ago. And he's getting a hell of a press, by the way. I wish I'd got that kind of press. When I fell afoul of Ofcom, they're showing all these beatific pictures of him. He was in a Doctor Who, some kind of commercial, a promotion for Doctor Who, where whoever the guy was who was playing Doctor Who then, he's wearing the Rwandan stabber is wearing the same coat and scarf and hat and everything and coming out of the TARDIS. And there's a takeaway from that too, that having crappy pop culture in common doesn't mean you're an assimilated, functioning citizen of your country. It never has done. Some of you heard my show on the Merry Widow Waltz a couple of years ago, which was, in fact, one of the most famous exponents of this. It was the most successful Viennese operetta that had ever hit Broadway, and it was also Hitler's favourite. So the fact that Hitler likes the same stuff that the Broadway theatre-goers do doesn't make any difference to his plans for world domination. I'm sick of the wankery. Just sick of it. Just totally sick of it. The banal, shallow rubbish oh, you know, if we can just get them interested in the same things our kids are interested in, lousy third-rate hippity-hop or whatever, then they'll be perfectly... That isn't what assimilation is. Now, people are saying, oh, well, they got this wrong. They were misinformed, so they're going out and they're threatening people and they're burning and looting because they think it's some Muslim guy. Look, there's a track record here of Muslims stabbing people all over Europe. Stabbing is a Muslim thing, but it's also a Rwandan thing. 30 years ago, big Rwandan genocide carried out with machetes. And 30 years ago, by the way, machete was a word that turned up in the newspapers largely in relation to Rwanda. 3 decades on, we're now so vibrantly diverse that machete is in the domestic dictionary. Because there's guys with machete walking around British cities and European cities and whatever. So these riots, whatever you want to call them, arose because of the dishonesty of the state in covering the stabbings of the little girls. Because they want to normalize the stabbings of the little girls. They have no other... The root cause here is migration on a scale that should never have been countenanced. Migration that, as you see with all these big shot senior police officers now going, oh, salam alaikum, you know, that's the first phrase they've learned. Next, they'll be going the full Allahu Akbar on you. Because the British state understands that it's a numbers game. And at the same time, they're not going to permit you to talk. That's why they are threatening to arrest people for retweets, because they're not going to permit you to talk about this subject, by which I mean immigration. That's the subject. All the rest is bollocks. People want to have an honest conversation about immigration. And if you're worried that Tommy Robinson, oh, he seems a bit extreme, he's not, you know, he's not quite respectable. Yeah, well, if the respectable parties decide that they're not going to... Again, it's a famous line of mine that certain people quote a lot. I said it 20 years ago. If the political culture forbids the respectable politicians from raising certain subjects, then people will turn to unrespectable ones. That explains the rise of the National Front, now the National Rally in France, and a lot of other things. It explains Trump. Trump in 2015 came down that election, escalator, and he started talking about something real at a time when all the respectable politicians, Jeb and Marco and Kasich and whoever the other guys were all just talking the usual bollocks that had nothing to do with anybody's lives. And when he came down and he said a few words about Mexico not sending its best, that's real. And he made that election real. But, you know, there are powerful forces that don't want anybody talking about anything real. And the price, you know... I said the other day, when my children were born, I had this thing where I'd just start weeping in movies where people threatened or menaced kids. I just couldn't handle it. Because when your kids are born, when they're young, it's different when they get all teenagey and, you know, what have you. But when they're young, the thing you're aware of is their vulnerability. And the idea that you just, that these parents in Southport, which is just, you know, for the non-English, it's just a, you know, a coastal resort. Resort makes it sound a bit more glamorous than it is, I think. But it's just a sort of sleepy town on the Irish Sea. You would think there that you were far from the world's woes. But you're not. Because of what Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak and all the rest have done to you. You take your little girl to, oh, it's the summer, it's always a long summer, the kids get a bit restless, or what's going on? Oh, well, they've got some, like, a Taylor Swift thing going on. Southport, oh, it's, you know, 7 miles away. That sounds great. And you never see your little girl again. And somehow the state would rather talk about anything else. So if you're concerned about the dead kids, you must be far right, because you're on the same side as Tommy Robinson. It actually speaks well for Tommy Robinson that he cares more about the dead kids than Keir Starmer does. You know, people go on about Tommy Robinson, by the way, and this is, again, if you're looking at, if the police are knocking on the door because you retweeted something by Tommy or Katie Hopkins or my dear friend who's been doing such a terrific reporting job on these events, Sammy Woodhouse, who's a victim of the culture that the Uniparty imported to the United Kingdom. Sammy's been doing some terrific reporting, but if you retweet Sammy and the coppers are now at the door, when you get sent to prison, this is why I don't blame Tommy Robinson for getting the hell out of the UK, because he knows this. The prisons are now run by the Muslims because they make up a large proportion of the prisoners in the UK. So they run those prisons. So if you're an Islamophobe who winds up in a prison, you're like a big, fit, healthy Islamophobe, you're not going to be such a fit and healthy Islamophobe when you come out of that prison. The UK is colluding with evil in some of this. David Smale says, "Hi, Mark. Given that two-tier Keir has effectively declared all-out war on the indigenous population of his own country, can you foresee any circumstances in which he or his party could be forced out of office? Well done on your reply to the repellent ChrisBy81. That's his Twitter handle. Is this, that's just, if you didn't see that earlier today, this creep, I don't tweet, I tweet twice a decade or something, but this creep, he sees Samantha being interviewed by me on GB News. It's a clip that was revived. And he immediately says to Samantha that he labels her. I'm so sick of the boring labels as well. Nobody can do critical thinking anymore. So all we have are labels. Oh, racist. So he calls her, she's mixed race. And she's she was sexually abused for a decade from the age of 5. She's, you know, whatever she is now, 21 or 22, basically until the day before yesterday, all her memories are just of sexual abuse. There's a picture of her that she's posted. You can see at Stein Online. The 5-year-old girl she was when the abuse started. This creep who knows nothing because he's just masturbating all over the internet says she's a racist. This is like some little whitey white pants who's calling her a racist who doesn't care about the victims, because that's all he can do is label. So he's actually calling a biracial child sexual abuse victim a racist. This is... The big problem, as it was put to me by a Swedish lady whose children were sexually assaulted in Östersund, in the municipal swimming baths there, and I met her a few years ago, and I'd never heard the word before, but I asked her where were the Swedish men when the Muslim men were assaulting her children and their friends. And she said, oh, they're all manginas. Well, this guy here, ChrisBy81, he's a classic mangina. He thinks he demonstrates his progressive virtues by insulting a victim of 10 years of child sexual abuse. Amazing. David Smale says, hi, Mark. Given that two-tier Keir has effectively declared all-out war on the indigenous population of his own country. Did I already? Oh, I already read that. question. Yeah. Is he going to be forced out of office? No. He's got a huge majority in the House of Commons. So to be forced out of office, he would have to lose his majority in the House of Commons. The members of the House of Commons would have to decline to support him. And all the opposition parties, including all the people who are running for the leadership of the Conservative Party, have been head-faked into basically buying into Keir Starmer's view of what's going on. If you're the sort of person who gets upset about kids being stabbed to death, you must be part of the far right. And so, they're doing a very good job of enforcing that. And when people like Nigel, when he pops his head up above the parapet, Nigel Farage, and he says, oh, we should be talking about immigration or whatever, then they all immediately say, oh, well, these are the Farage riots or whatever. They're determined to all of the doesn't matter whether it's the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Party, the Scottish Nationalist Party, whatever. They all want to prevent this subject ever being raised. And if they did decide to toss two-tier Keir overboard, the person who replaces him would just be, it's like, you know, Biden for Kamala, and Kamala then picks the Waltz guy or whatever, you know. This is politics as a completely pointless charade, or charade, as they say in the UK. Toby Pilling says, how did we end up in Britain with Elon Musk having to hold two-tier Keir to account single-handedly, as the whole mainstream media just followed the approved narrative? It's very interesting. This all kind of started, and in fact, Sammy Woodhouse and Samantha Smith and various other chums wound up replying to Elon Musk on this. He found the old headline about 1,400 girls being abused by grooming gangs by Pakistani rapists in Rotherham. And he put up, I think it was the Daily Mirror front page, and he said, is this still going on? And as you know, if you watch the Mark Steyn show, it is still going on. I can't remember the name of that whatever shopping centre it was, but where I, after meeting with Sammy and some of her friends, and a friend of hers had mentioned that it's still going on at this particular shopping centre, I took the scenic route back to the railway station. I think I was staying in Sheffield that night. And I came to the shopping centre and I couldn't see anything very much going on, but I waited there just about 15 minutes and the middle-aged Pakistani guy came round in a rather good car. I think it was an Audi. And he circles and he circles again. And then on the third go-round, he's got this little schoolgirl sitting in the passenger seat. And he doesn't circle again because he doesn't need to. That's Rotherham. And I have no reason to believe it's not still going on today. And when people say Elon Musk is the only guy who mentioned this, Toby's point here is quite right, that one of the huge disappointments, the Spectator's coverage of these riots, for example, has been absolutely terrible. They had some piece by some wanker sort of saying, you know, these people are behaving as the Bolsheviks did. So he does this sort of historical comparison. They're not, you know, you should, I shouldn't say this because it's been, you know, half a lifetime since I went round to the Speccy, but they used to be in Doughty Street. And every so often when I was in London, I'd go and have lunch with Boris or whoever the editor was. It wasn't something I particularly looked forward to. I liked Liz Anderson, the arts editor, and there were one or two others. But there'd be some nice girl on the desk, you know, with a name like Veronica or whatever, who would you know, she'd grown up in the country and she came from a good family and she just wanted to pretend to work for a bit until she got married. And so she'd be the secretary at the Spectator. And they'd had a sort of vibe. But they're not the people who know towns like Rotherham. Because even if you're in the media and you came from Rotherham, once you get out, you never go back. And so they don't know what the policies that they think mean great West End restaurants and, you know, some vibrant bit of pseudo-ethnic theatre at a carnival once in a while. They don't understand what it's done to huge swathes of England and other Western nations. And they don't care. You know, it's a class thing. They didn't care about Sammy Woodhouse because she's a white working class girl. Same with Samantha Smith. And they, in every town that this goes on in, the girls, whether it's Sammy Woodhouse in Rotherham or Samantha Smith in Telford, are just, quote, white slags and, quote, packy shaggers. And that's why, as Sammy was reporting, what's going on in Rotherham is extraordinary. The Holiday Inn there is full of migrants. In other words, after whatever it was, two decades of industrial scale child gang rape in Rotherham that the authorities turned a blind eye to until Sammy and co. kicked up a fuss about it and had to take it outside Rotherham because the South Yorkshire Constabulary and the rest of the gang wouldn't do anything about it. So they think, oh, yeah, that bloody Sammy Woodhouse, she and her pals got us all in trouble. I tell you what we'll do. We'll move all these migrants, these nice young Muslim men, into the Holiday Inn in Rotherham. That's how little we care about what went on there. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're as well as you can be. The so-called UK liberal left has come up with the solution to crushing dissent from the approved establishment narrative. Banning X. X, that's what used to be Twitter. Banning X in the UK is their solution. From a suspension of service when the natives are protesting over uncontrolled immigration to an outright ban, the chatter is gathering pace. Musk versus Starmer would make an interesting catchweight fight, but when it comes to suppression of free speech, who's your money on, given X is now the leading source of news in the UK, asked Chris Davis. Yes, it's astonishing to me, this. The number of supposedly respectable people going on the respectable shows like Good Morning Britain and basically calling for bans on social media, not just X, but all social media. Because unfortunately, yes, you know, it's not all totally far right on there. You can still find the occasional non-far right cat video on Facebook. But unfortunately, this is where the far right is organizing and all the rest of it. So it may be necessary just to completely ban it. They're not very confident in, they're confident in their power, but not in the arguments that in free societies underpin your power, because they wouldn't be proposing things like, they wouldn't be sitting around on Good Morning Britain and seriously discussing whether, you know, it's just so bad, this, you know, we've got all these far right people demonstrating now, so maybe we just should have an outright ban on it. Yeah, this is the acceleration into darkness. Owen Morgan says, I didn't think any British Prime Minister could get off to a worse start than Major Blair, Brown, Cameron, May, Sunak without being sabotaged. I missed out Truss because her time in number 10 blatantly was torpedoed by the media and by the city. Hasn't Starmer already demonstrated his hopeless incompetence by his appointees and his actions? Is he Britain's Trudeau? I take you mean Justin Trudeau on that, but in fact, Justin, you know, didn't have as bad a first month as Keir Starmer did. It took a little longer that for people to have the measure of them. The thing about it is I'm losing interest in politics because I don't honestly believe that that Keir Starmer or Kamala Harris or whoever is running the show. I mean, what we have is, and in a sense, you know, COVID sort of exposed that when every single Western nation except Sweden mysteriously adopts within days the same policy. And so I'm not, you know, these seem to me to be front men for whatever else is going on. And I don't pretend to know fully what that is. But I don't... Keir Starmer, here's where I disagree. Everyone thinks, oh, Keir Starmer, on the right, so-called, not, you know, they think he's been tone-deaf. Well, I'm not sure by declaring war, as it were, on the indigenous population of the country he purports to lead. I don't think it's being tone-deaf. I think he's doing what they did with the January 6 guys. And actually, the January 6 horror stories are likely to be where a lot of this ends up, or the Canadian trucker horror stories. The state basically decides to make an example of these people. There's one January 6th guy, and this is where, don't wave that constitution at me! It's American Constitution with the constitutional right to a speedy trial. There's a guy who's been in prison for over 3 years from January the 6th. I think it's 1,300 days. 1,300 days. So we're getting close to 4 years. He's been in prison for four years awaiting his speedy trial, which is scheduled apparently for September. Evil, evil, evil. Don't wave that constitution at me. Because the constitutional guarantee to a speedy trial doesn't mean anything if they want to get you for January the 6th. And it's going to be the same for this. It's going to be, that's why they're pretty confident. Because if you did this at any other time in human history, you would be setting up revolutionary conditions. But they're pretty convinced that what with technology now, they can basically neutralize revolutionary committees conditions whenever they want. Ellen Como writes, Cher Monsieur Stein, chaleureuse salutation des maritimes. I've been catching up on Cobland Q&A during the last few weeks as I was busy settling into my new home province of New Brunswick. Ellen was previously a Quebecer. And I think on the first Mark Stein cruise, I used to refer to her as the token Francophone, which wasn't actually true. She was certainly a Francophone we were very happy to have. And I certainly hope she's in the Francophone part of New Brunswick and not surrounded by a lot of tiresome Anglos. I used to go to New Brunswick a lot, and I very much appreciated on the Gaspé Peninsula, if you got down the far end, the French restaurateurs would be incredibly indiscreet by comparison with their Anglo counterparts. So you would have the most amazing conversations about topics where they just said what they thought. Imagine that. Ellen continues, first off, truly sorry about Marvin. He was a very special cat. He looked a lot like my Bella, whose company I've enjoyed for over 14 years now. Yeah, I do miss Marvin, especially in my present health condition, so I'm not like swanning around as much as I used to. So your circle becomes inevitably a little more shrunken and diminished. Second of all, truly sorry about the Ofcom decision. What a huge disappointment from the country that gave us the Magna Carta. Third, my Norwegian half apologizes for my mother's homelands, ridiculous decision to recognize Palestine as a country, though they did also give Yasser Arafat the Nobel Peace Prize, so I suppose it shouldn't surprise me. Do they not realize that you get more of what you reward? Palestine isn't a country. Now, I was talking about Ireland just a moment ago. And the interesting thing about the Irish is if you go back to, you know, whatever it was, 2 day, we covered it, in fact, on the 100 Years Ago show, the Anglo-Irish treaty couple of days after they'd signed all that. And so Viscount Fitzalan at Dublin Castle invites Michael Collins over. And they shake hands and they have a bit of a chit chat. And then Lord Fitzalan shows him round the castle and shows him all the civil service departments and says, you know, under this agreement, you're going to be running these things now. And the interesting thing about that is that for all the romantic revolutionary zeal of that first generation Irish revolutionaries, they got down just to, oh yeah, okay, so we have to run the Irish post office now, and we're in charge of the Irish Department of Transportation, and we've got to figure out what to you take it from here. I'm just going to sit in the head office and put my feet up on the desk. It's Lord Fitzalan's basic take about that, and they did just get on with it. And there's an impalace, and that's what you would do if you were interested in setting up a country. There's nothing like that in Gaza or in the West Bank, where basically, you know, the hospitals are used to store munitions, or that there's you could give them a country and they've basically been given that territory and they've look at what they've done with it. At some point, you have to get real. There are 58 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and they vote as a bloc. That's getting close to two-thirds. That's close to just under a third of the total membership of the United Nations. And they vote as a bloc. I don't really think we need any more. You know, basically, United Kingdom and France and Ireland and whatnot are all going to be voting with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation soon. I don't think we need any more Islamic, decrepit Islamic stands. Elisa Angel says, Salaam alaikum, Mark. I'm glad you're up to doing the show today. Would you please tell us about the Ofcom ruling against you and your appeal process? Are you arguing to enlighten judges, or have all the judges been ruined by the new math? Has there been a dramatic and permanent change in how typical Westerners perceive our freedoms? I think there has. I don't want to talk about the Ofcom ruling specifically because I haven't read the full, because I've been haven't been in the best of health, and my doctors get very annoyed if they find me reading things like judicial decisions against me. I mean, it's basically killing me, this stuff. It's killing me, yeah. I haven't yet read it, and I've left it in the hands of the professionals. But when you say typical Westerners, how they perceive our freedoms, we are losing. This is the most important thing. And as I've just said, don't wave that constitution at me and all the rest of it, because it doesn't really make any difference. We're all going off the cliff in different ways, slightly different ways, but actually remarkably similar ways. And in every Western nation, we are losing the habits of liberty. So I talked about on Good Morning Britain, reasonable and respectable people are sitting around having a conversation on whether Elon Musk, now he's set his cap against Keir Starmer, whether Elon Musk's Twitter should be banned from the UK, as which I've written about before. Rumble, for example, is presently banned in France. So they're more and more comfortable with that. And it's not just some, you know, Anglo-European thing. In the United States, this survey in which people thought the First Amendment, which I'm not terribly, because the First Amendment's cost me whatever it is now, 13 years of my life. But the you think, oh, well, at least in theory, it's a theoretical commitment to freedom of expression. But they just did this poll in which a majority of Americans think it goes too far, the First Amendment. So we're losing the habits of liberty, which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, because as you saw during the COVID years, that you can do incredible things to people. You can destroy their children's mental health. You can close down their mom and pop business. But an enormous number of people will go along with it. This guy, who's now the vice presidential nominee in the United States, as governor of Minnesota, basically was a tyrant. And he kept it up for like a year after everybody. He kept it up until the summer of 2022, after almost everywhere else on the planet had said, okay, we're going to have to pack it in, all this. He kept his emergency powers till then. People, we're losing the habits of liberty. And once that happens to a people, it doesn't matter what theoretical rights they have. Tell you what, let's pause a moment from the passing Charivari. Oh, no, we don't do that anymore, do we? We've moved all the music on this show over to Serenade Radio, Saturdays, 5 p.m. London time, in order to free up more time here to talk about who's up 2 points in Iowa. So our show will ne'er be sullied by my niche Canadian musical obsessions again. So we're live around the planet. It's a quarter to the hour. That's a quarter to four North American Eastern Time, quarter to nine British Summer Time, a little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. And in the absence of music, we go straight on to a question. Jojo from Texas says, I desperately want your take on the replacement ticket for the Biden-Kamala ticket, now billed as the Waltzing McCumla ticket. Many thanks, Mark, and all the best to you. Stan from Texas. I don't know, I can't. You have to be interested in it. You have to believe that Kamala is the effective chief executive of the United States. We know that Biden isn't. Because he's been brain dead for the entirety of his term. So they finally feel we can't prevent people from figuring this out now. So we're getting rid of him and we're putting in Kamala. Who seriously thinks Kamala is making these decisions? I mean, who seriously thinks Kamala, if she wins on November the whatever, is going to be the effective chief executive of the United States? Who thinks this guy Waltz is going, you know, in the event that they decide to ease Kamala out, who thinks he's going to be the exec? We're being told that our politics is a joke. We're being told, and people, you know, it used to be, you can say what you like, take whoever you want, Churchill, Calvin Coolidge, the Marquess of Salisbury. These are guys who ran their governments. And what we're being told now is that that doesn't matter. We'll change, you know, we'll change some of the players. But it's like, as I said, in America Alone, you know, it's like going to see Cats after a cast change. What the hell difference does it make? You know, this is here's the problem. Here's the problem. If you want something to change after November, and actually, that's a rather interesting passage in that Viktor Orban speech that I've been talking about. He has some rather interesting thoughts on what he thinks Trump will be doing. But the question becomes, the question is, can Trump win in a free and fair election? Now, the problem for them was that Biden was falling so far behind Trump. I mean, the thing about it is there's, you know, 50 states, but, you know, California, New York, you forget, they're not very competitive. They're not competitive at all or whatever. So the competitive states are very small in number. And in terms of deciding the election, they boil down to half a dozen red states with big blue cities in them. And in the blue cities, like Philadelphia, it's possible to steal the election. If you have to steal it on the scale you would have had to steal it if Biden had stayed in the race, then you would need hundreds of thousands of people in on that plot. Now, then they put Kamala in. And the thing about it is they've gone full Obama here. It's like back to 2008, where they're just, except the difference is that Kamala isn't, doesn't function in as well as Obama did. So she can't do interviews. She hasn't done any interviews. I mean, this is how bad it is. They haven't even let her do softballs with George Stephanopoulos or whatever. So, but they figure it's okay because it's a foreshortened campaign now. It's only going to be a couple of months. If they can just keep her away from certain things for a couple more months, she'll breathe. Oh, it's so great to shatter the glass ceiling. I'm sick of the bollocks. You know, as I said, America is broke. It's the brokest. I said this 13 years ago, and all that's happened is it's got a lot more broke. It's the brokest nation in history. It's the brokiest broke nation in the history of brokenness. And it doesn't matter because America, the dollar is the global currency. But nobody, if everybody was all getting together at Bretton Woods or whatever today, nobody would make the dollar the global currency. And in fact, much of the rest of the world, again, I mentioned this, talking about the BRICS and the Shanghai Economic Council, whatever it's called, the rest of the world has quite advanced its plans for the post-dollar world. And when the rug is yanked out from under the dollar, then you'll wake up in the morning and you'll be living in the Weimar Republic. And the Chinese want to manage the destruction of the dollar. They're quite clever like that, but you don't. That's not a terribly hostile thing to do. You could argue that Eisenhower in the 50s was quite happy to manage the destruction of sterling. It doesn't, you know, nations calculate their own interests. Nations have no eternal friends or eternal enemies. They only have eternal interests, as the line goes. And so China has calculated its interests, and it's quite and it's prosecuting them quite seriously and at quite speed. So how, unless you're as totally moronized as the NPR, CNN, PBS, New York Times, Washington Post classes, why do you think whether somebody is a Jamaican, Indian, Quebecer, or whatever the hell Kamala Harris. Why is that a rational basis on which to pick someone to run your government? I mean, all this stuff is moronizing, but if it's relentless, and it's as relentless as it is with the American media, and this is interesting to me, this, because you know, we were talking about the First Amendment and everything. In theory, we could have all kinds of newspapers in America, and we could have all kinds of radio and television stations, and there's no Ofcom or anything like that. And yet, overwhelmingly, they peddle this drivel. so that for the global superpower, which is broke and is watching its historical moment be destroyed, we're supposed to be excited because Kamala Harris would be shattering the glass ceiling for every other Jamaican, Indian, Quebecer who's out there. This is so childish, and it's absolutely destroyed, and they don't weigh that constitution, don't do that. We're not a democracy, we're a constitutional republic. Bollocks! What kind of constitutional republic elects its leaders on this basis? You're not a constitution. This isn't anything like the system the founding fathers foresaw. It's just drivelling crap. I wouldn't let my kindergartner be fed this kind of rubbish all day long. But grown-ups conduct the public discourse of the United States in this fashion. Robert Bridges says the Democrat Party primaried out two of its more strident progressives, one in New York and the other in Missouri. However, with the selected, not elected twins of Harris and Waltz, the party as a whole has further lurched Marxist. I wouldn't say Marxist. You know, show me the bit in Das Kapital where Marx, or show me where Lenin, or show me where Stalin wants to put tampons in the toilets of grade school boys for just because little Jimmy might be getting visited by Aunt Flo that day. So you have to have a tampon dispenser in the boys' toilet at your local grade school. That's what this guy, Midwestern Tim, that's what nice Midwestern Tim did. It's way beyond Marxism. And that's another point. That's really the other point is another point we need to come up with a new way of looking at this stuff. Because this particular thing, this trans madness, this idea that boys can have periods, don't blame Marx for that. Marx knew what a woman was. Keir Starmer doesn't know what a woman is. Ketanji Brown Jackson, or whatever she's called, doesn't know what a woman is. But Karl Marx knew what a woman was. And Vladimir Ilyich Lenin knew what a woman was. And Joseph Stalin knew what a woman was, too. Robert continues, when will the gentrified leader... I'm in a cranky mood today. I apologize. I probably shouldn't have done the show. So if I'm getting a bit overheated, do forgive me. But I'm every time you step away from the hamster wheel of crap, you become aware of just how the time is slipping away. I'm not even talking about to arrest the rise of China. I think, as Viktor Orban does, that's basically the idea of Asian dominance of the world for however many generations is pretty much a done deal now. But I'm just talking about, in more modest terms, trying to figure out a way to save enough of sanity that our children and grandchildren don't wind up living in totalitarian toilets. It's worrying to me that. Robert says, when will the gentrified leaders of the party, coastal, white, rich, insulated, come to recognize that the fundamental transformation of Obama's party will eventually not include them? I don't think anybody thinks like that. And that goes whether you're talking about the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution. I think an awful lot of people think they're going to come out on the winning side and historically absolutely stunned when suddenly the revolution devours them. But I don't think we're anywhere near the point. I mean, if you just look at Jews, for example, this guy in Pennsylvania, he was basically not considered for the Veep slot because he's a Jew. And so he was trying to de-Jew himself in recent, in order to keep himself still competitive. And there's like There's jokes out there on Twitter about how he now that Carmilla frosted him out, he regrets having his foreskin reattached. And there's jokes like that out there on Twitter. But basically, because the demographic energy in the Democratic Party is against Jews. And I'm not just talking about your crazy Muslims in Dearborn or whatever, but also among, you know, young upscale whites who've been to American colleges and think that the Jews are the new Nazis. And yet. Watch Election Day in November. How many Jews will still be voting Democrat just because they've always voted Democrat? And just because they can't, you know, they can't face the hardest thing in the world is trying to get someone to admit he was suckered. And basically, if you belong to the Democrat Party and you're a Jew, you're being suckered. You know, Joe Lieberman figured that out. I'm trying to think the last time I saw him, but I'll tell you, I remember the last time I saw Hadassah, his widow. She came to a speech of mine. That's how far the Liebermans went in their understanding of how much the Democrat Party had changed. But you know, most of those Jews are still going to be voting Democrat in November. Mark Scheer says, do you see a reasonable best case going forward for the United States? You know, anything that's not tyrannical, poor and icky. Well, those things are a little bit related, actually, Mark, because I think we're being set up for being poorer. I think that's why all the talk, you know, this idea of eating, you can't have beef anymore. You've got to eat bugs, and all the bugs are going to be manufactured by Bill Gates in five global food hubs across the planet. And this, all your 15-minute cities. And we don't really need commercial air travel or actually private motor vehicle ownership anymore. They're trying to set us up for being poor. And in part, that's because we are going to be poor because, you know, we've diverted our energy into non-productive activities, essentially, certainly not any form of primary wealth creation. Now, what helps that? Well, one way to make it easier to manage a great, a great seething Latin American favela is by letting anyone who wants to come into the country come into the country. So then you need a stronger government to mediate relations between the various hostile tribes. But I think we're... Oh, you wanted an optimistic. Gary Cooper in High Noon. Except it'll be on the Mall in Washington. And the place will be deserted. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. It'll all work out. John Maravich says, the move by the 10 BRICS-plus countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa and others, seem poised to at least partially switch from using the dollar as a reserve currency for international transactions. Is the massively indebted US moving through the gradually, then suddenly phase of bankruptcy? Well, the thing about this is it can't go on. You can't just keep raising the debt ceiling. But nobody in Washington gives any thought as to lowering the debt, reducing the debt, paying off the debt. I pointed out, I was on a panel in New Orleans or somewhere, I think it was, and I pointed out that New Zealand had paid off back then, however, was it under Sir John Key? Might even have been before that. But under whichever prime minister it was, had paid off its crown debt. And Charles Krauthammer, who's sitting next to me, sort of laughed. He goes, well, that's New Zealand. They don't have to do any of the things we do, like be the policeman of the world, and so have to be responsible for 40% of the planet's military spending, so we can have all this state-of-the-art equipment that we then leave for the goat herds in Afghanistan to have fun with. And, how's that 40% of military expenditure worked out for you? I mean, what's the point of it if you don't win anything? You know, there are hard questions that should have been asked after the end of the Cold War. But the fact of the matter is, this idea that every time you crash a significant barrier, $10 trillion in debt, $20 trillion in debt, $30 trillion in debt, look at this, we survived all that, let's shoot for $40 trillion in federal debt. All you're doing is ensuring that when the crash does come, it's going to be worse than you can ever imagine. Now, we were told rubbish about what the sanctions would do to Russia. We were told that Russia, by being kicked out of the SWIFT international bank processing system, by being kicked out of the SWIFT system, it would be impossible for Russia to do business. Well, Russia found workarounds. And the funny thing is, once you start finding a workaround or two, eventually when you're sitting around the table, the Russians and the Chinese and the Saudis and whoever, you've all figured out little ways to bypass the dollar's hegemony, what's going to bring you back on the reservation? The more leisurely we get about this, John, the more sudden the suddenness will be. That's the point there. David says, hi, Mark. It seems if the current Canadian, French, British, both uniparty versions and German examples are anything to go by, that these days the weaker a government is, the more authoritarian, soft or otherwise, it becomes. And it would appear as well that the so-called democratic controls in some places, this used to be called elections in the above countries, are not working. In fact, no matter which party is in power, they seem to completely ignore the wishes of the population, the majority of which are small c conservative. How far down the authoritarian path towards totalitarianism do you think this realistically could go? There has to be some stopping point somewhere where it has to bottom out. What say you? No, I don't think so. Because technology has enabled a degree of absolute tyranny that was not possible. Tocqueville has a very good point about this. I quote it in After America. He says at one time, in the empires of old, the emperor theoretically exercised absolute power. But what could he do to you? Because he's sitting in his big palace in the capital city, and you're in your little hovel 173 miles away. And okay, every once in a while, he might send an emissary to gallop into your dooryard and give you a hard time about something. But he can't tyrannize you every second of every hour, 24/7. They now think that they can do that. That was the great insight of Orwell in 1984, which I think I said in my intro when we did it on Tales for Our Time. But Orwell's thing, and don't forget he's talking about this right at the beginning of the television age. So right at the moment, and not when people didn't have a lot. He wrote it, whatever it was, 5 years before the Queen's coronation. So most people didn't have television sets, but some people had television sets. You know, in America, people were watching Milton Berle or whatever. So they get this contraption, and they put it in the corner to watch Milton Berle. And Orwell has the idea, what if it's not just one way, though? What if Milton Berle can watch you right back? And that's the great Insight in 1984. And now all the things that people rave about, the tools of convenience, are actually tools of control, whether you're talking about the telephone, right, which is basically like your electronic ankle bracelet now, whether you're talking about the laptop, which, you know, they say with some of these things, you can turn it on and photograph the guy looking at the laptop, or the automobile. I talked when I went to Ukraine about how the Hungarian rental car I was in knew when I'd reached the Hungarian border because the engine cut out, it stopped and wouldn't go into Ukraine. I wound up having to walk into Ukraine. And when I mentioned that on the show, I said, if you think this is just going to be confined to Ukrainian war zones, no, it won't. The nature of the car will be changed so that if you don't get on board with the 15-minute city, you'll just drive to your town line because you're going to visit your Auntie Mabel in the next town, and the car will just die at the town line. You know, there are literally, this is the point Tocqueville saw. What if it was possible for the emperor to exercise 24/7 control? You look at what that director of public prosecutions Stephen Johnson, whatever his name is, in London said today about they're going to arrest people for retweets. They can do that to you now. We are moving into this is why. The significant proportion of the population that, notwithstanding the COVID years, is happy to lose the habits of liberty is very distressing, because it can't be done on a partisan basis, this, if you're hoping that just your fellow conservatives or whatever can save you from this stuff. No, it's going to need a lot more people than that, because right now 50% and maybe more are happy to let the government have those kinds of powers. Mark Stein, Clubland Q&A across the planet. Come and join the club. You better to join early, because one day you're going to fire up your laptop or whatever, and this website isn't going to be here because they'll have figured out a way to take it down. We're going to be in our last photocopier in the woods scenario, so you're going to want to be on the mimeographed bad carbon copy list when that happens. So come and join us in the Mark Stein Club. I know some of you still want closing music. Tough. We've moved all that to Saturdays on 7 Radio, 5 p.m. London time, which is 6 p.m. in Western Europe, 12 noon North American Eastern. Hope you'll join me for this weekend's show. I'm going to be playing one of my favorite ever number one records. But that'll do it for today. Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will round up the internet as only she can. And of course, I thank Laura for pinch hitting. I'm going all kind of American there, aren't I? Pinch hitting. Oh, wait, I think they say that in cricket now too. But I thank Laura for pinch hitting for me last week. And don't forget our concluding episode of our current Tale for Our Time. Bulldog Drummond will be coming up in a couple of hours at Stein Online. As I said, feel free to join the Mark Stein Club. But for existing club members, if you have a Stein shy chum in your life, there's a Mark Stein Club gift membership with his or her name on it. So give that some thought too. Stay safe, stay free, stay well.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.